You're listening to the Economics Review Podcast with your host, Adi Golcha. From Congress to Wall Street and finance to philosophy, tune into the Economics Review to hear from world-leading experts on current events and cutting-edge research. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome back to the Economics Review. Our guest today is a professor of global management and the former CEO and director general of the Thunderbird School of Global Management at Arizona State University. Before joining ASU, he was the Christian Gerard Jebsen Chair for Responsible Leadership and the director of the Global CEO Center at IMD in Switzerland. His latest book is titled Enterprise China, Adopting a Competitive Strategy for Business Success. It's my pleasure to welcome to the show Dr. Alan Morrison. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, it's great to be here. I appreciate what you're doing to add to the general level of education and excite people on this important topic.
Absolutely. So firstly, as always, I'd like to start off by asking you to introduce yourself and tell us a bit about your background.
Yeah, thank you. Alan Morrison, I'm a professor of global management at the Thunderbird School of Global Management. Prior to my role as a professor, I was also the CEO, a director general of the school, one of the largest, most global schools of international management in the world. And prior to that, I was a professor and chair at the IMD school in Lausanne, Switzerland. And prior to that, a professor at INSEAD. And so my career has been highly focused on international topics, global leadership, global strategy, global management topics. I've also spent time as a visiting professor twice at different leading business schools in China, served on the board of publicly traded U.S. NASDAQ traded Chinese company, and have been working in and around China for the past 35 years.
Okay, what a fantastic career. So the first thing I wanted to talk to you about today is the term Enterprise China. That you guys explain as following, quote, the size of the 135 individual Chinese companies on the Global 500 list and the thousands more beyond that list deserve careful assessment and analysis. However, looking at them individually can easily obscure the collective monolith that includes not just these firms, but also an entity not on the list. That entity is the number one employer and the second largest revenue generator on the planet today. We're talking about the Chinese state, which includes national, regional, and municipal governments. It is this commercial totality that we should assess and analyze. We label it Enterprise China. So for someone who's not familiar with the business landscape in China, this Enterprise China versus Chinese enterprise distinction isn't immediately obvious. You know, there isn't really an American equivalent. So can you tell us a bit about what you mean by Enterprise China and why that's important?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. It's a great question. Appreciate it. And let me start off with just a little bit of background on how we, and I say the U.S., but I would also add Western Europe, how we tend to think of competition and the competitive playing field. We have been taught and we teach our MBA students and business students that firms compete in a marketplace. We have buyers and suppliers and substitutes, and we can see our competitors. We're all driven by a profit motive. We fight it out for market share, and we seek a competitive advantage based on our products, our services, technology. The government is typically thought of as being important, but in the background, it's certainly not a direct actor. We listen to the government, we pay attention to regulations, but they are not considered part of the competitive domain for strategists. In China, the model is very different. In China, the government is the central player, which creates through ownership, through direct and through indirect influence, a gigantic ecosystem, an ecosystem that is influenced by the state firms. And we mentioned 135. These are the firms which are owned by the central government. There's also about 150,000 firms that are owned by provincial or municipal governments. And then according to our research, looking at medium-sized firms and up, and it's not exhaustive because it's really impossible to be exhaustive given how opaque some of these structures are. Every one of the firms that we have investigated and studied in depth, had even those that are privately owned, have some state ownership, either through the principal vehicle of the firm or through subsidiaries or joint venture partnerships. The hand of the state is directly involved in even privately held firms. We call these privately influenced or publicly influenced entities. And so you'll typically see a Chinese firm privately held, but it has a factory and the factory itself is 23% owned by a municipal government. And the municipal government, of course, wants the company to succeed. And so it provides subsidized loans through a municipal bank. This is a very normal kind of structure in China. And even companies which have no direct immediate ownership from the state are highly influenced by state regulators or by signals that they receive from the government, various governments, in terms of who they should partner with, in terms of accessing investment money, in terms of accessing technology and sharing technology, in terms of whether they should export, move internationally, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's the government, the state, that is that plays a central role, a pivotal role in defining the ecosystems, the playing field, in defining the rules of engagement. And so we call this Enterprise China. And so when we're in the West thinking about competing, we should be thinking about competing with Enterprise China, this kind of monolithic organization, as opposed to a bunch of Chinese enterprises.
So, I mean, just because Chinese companies, you know, are not, they don't operate with the same level of independence as American companies, or, you know, perhaps as you stated, the municipal government or the regional government might own a small percentage of the company. To what extent does that really impact, say, day-to-day operations? And you know, when an American company and a Chinese company are going head-to-head in a market, to what extent is that really involved? And can you say, give us an example of how that might play in or factor into a Chinese company's operations?
Yeah, so it impacts them in so many ways. We've seen, for example, with the potential IPO, the planned IPO of Didi, which is which was clawed back by the government. We saw the same thing with Ant Financial, with its ties to Alibaba, also clawed back and canceled. So we see this happening directly with these private enterprises, where the state is, through direct or indirect signaling, guiding the IPOs, guiding the financing of companies. But beyond financing, these enterprises are, they're guided by different kinds of motives. Those motives are based, not entirely, but one of the motives is to dominate the domestic marketplace. And so as we see these Chinese companies growing, it's not necessarily that they're driven by profits per se, but they're driven by other strategic and political motives. They have access to discounted debt. They have access, one of the benefits is that when they're owned by the state, they typically don't have to pay any dividends. And so their cost of capital is lowered because the state provides subsidized financing. But then they also are able to keep more money because they don't have to pay out dividends like a traditional shareholder would have. The state is also influencing where factories are located. They're influencing the permitting process for new factories. They're creating these partnerships. They're saying company X, you need to work with company Y. They have certain technology, or they have certain people we'd like you to work with. And so the whole kind of ecosystem of commerce is heavily influenced by the interests of the state. And if your corporation wants to move against the state, wants to ignore the state's interests, then the indications are that you're going to have a very tough time in surviving, and certainly a tough time prospering, as we've seen, as I mentioned earlier, with the, with some of these very high profile examples.
Okay, so next I wanted to talk to you about the varying successes and failures of American companies in China, one of, if not the most lucrative overseas markets, with over a billion customers and a rapidly growing middle class. So many American companies like Uber, Google, eBay, et cetera, have struggled with the vastly different regulatory environments, consumer cultures, and so on, as they try to direct their Chinese expansion from conference rooms in Silicon Valley. So can you give us an overview of some of the primary challenges that have typically held American or other Western firms back when competing against Chinese businesses in China itself?
Right. So let me just discuss the difference, differences in kind of the industries, because the industries have a, and what industry you're in will have a big impact on your ability to compete successfully in China. The Chinese have identified 10 strategically important industries. They're broadly defined industries. And I'll just use the umbrella, the fourth industrial revolution, to kind of capture those industries, which are consistent with the future of technology and the future of what most of us in the West would say are the keys to value creation going forward. If you are in one of these industries, whether it's transportation or robotics, et cetera, those industries, according to the Chinese, will be dominated by Chinese firms in China, period. They've actually set market share targets. In some industries, it's 70%. In other industries, it's 80%. So if you're Boeing, if you're Airbus, both companies in aerospace, this is one of those targeted industries. And the Chinese have set targets, they've set dates, and they're serious about this, and they're moving aggressively in these industries. That's number one. Number two, in some industries, and you mentioned some of the Silicon Valley, the tech industries, in some cases, these companies have simply been forbidden to operate in China. In fact, many of our, you know, high-profile NASDAQ, social media kind of the metaverse kinds of companies, they are prohibited from operating in China. Companies like Uber, the New York Times, the Facebook, et cetera, these companies are just forbidden to operate in China. Number three, there are many industries that are have not been targeted by the Chinese. These are industries that are not viewed as strategically important from a growth value creation perspective. These are industries, for example, in food production, apparel, and so on. If you're in these industries as a American company, you will face challenges, but you will not be blocked by the Chinese. Chinese will, they will certainly create barriers and obstacles, but you can have a very prosperous company in China in these non-targeted industries. Now, how you do that and the obstacles you face these are not trivial questions. But what we want to delineate is the difference between those that are targeted in industries and those that are not targeted. Both face very, very different challenges vis-a-vis working in and with the Chinese.
Okay, so next I wanted to switch gears a little bit and talk about competing with China instead of in China. So there's been no shortage of Chinese companies, from Shein to TikTok to Alibaba to Xiaomi, dominate in the American marketplace. Overseas, enterprise China has notoriously expanded into a whole host of Belt and Road investments across Asia and China, completely overshadowing the West, although perhaps that's a consequence of foreign policy aims as opposed to merely superior business tactics. In any case, can you tell us a bit about the advantages and disadvantages that enterprise China faces, and how American or other non-Chinese firms can use those factors to compete more effectively?
Right. I think that the Chinese companies do face several advantages, as you mentioned. You did mention Belt and Road. What the Chinese have been very good at is tying foreign policy to economic development, to industrial policy in China. So they're pouring money into countries like Pakistan and even Eastern Europe, European countries like Romania and so on, have been receiving Belt and Road financing. And with that, the quid pro quo is you will work with Chinese companies. And so it's been a coordinated effort that has definitely helped Chinese companies. They're also able to get subsidized financing, which enables them certain advantages when it comes to foreign direct investment and acquiring companies overseas. Despite this, the Chinese are facing considerable headwind in overseas market. For one, you know, we talked about Belt and Road. There is a growing resistance in the recipients of Belt and Road investments, growing disdain, in fact, for these Chinese companies, which typically want to use Chinese labor as opposed to local labor, and which bring a lot of strings, which, you know, in the early days when you're getting the roads, the bridges, the railways look very enticing, but over time you realize you got to pay a steep bill for this. And so there's growing resentment and pushback. Chinese companies have been accused increasingly of abusive labor policies, et cetera, et cetera. So there's that challenge that they're facing, headwind in that area. But I think public relations is turning significantly against Chinese companies. You see this with Huawei, where being a Chinese technology company in mobile technology, that Chinese brand has worked decidedly against Huawei. It's also, I think, the biggest problem for Chinese companies, and what I spend a lot of time talking about, is the lack of depth of experience, of acumen amongst the ranks of senior Chinese companies in doing business in the West. Yes, they have access to the deep-pocketed state enterprises or state coffers, but when you don't understand the playing field in the United States or Europe, you target the wrong companies for acquisitions, or you pay significantly more than you should pay for those purchases. And so, you know, we see a lot of very negative consequences when Chinese investors are paying 50% premiums on foreign acquisitions, and then 3-4 years later having to justify this with ongoing losses. We're seeing a lack of understanding of Western consumers and Western channels of distribution, Western branding norms and policies, and misunderstanding of how the regulations work and how the ecosystems work in the West. So, China is the Chinese enterprises have certain advantages, there's no doubt, but I think they face some significant challenges and a lack really of management, leadership, maturity, and experience when they come to expanding in Japan and the United States and the UK and France, Germany, and so on.
Okay. So in the book, you guys talk about three strategic pillars of enterprise China's competitive strategy, which I wanted to go through one by one, starting with reducing dependency. So you talk in the book about a whole host of mechanisms that Chinese companies use to try to reduce the extent to which their business is reliant on foreign suppliers and firms. So can you tell us a bit about the how and why of this first pillar?
Yeah, I would first, you know, harken back to 150 years ago, 19th century, when China was wholly dependent on and occupied the various parts of China by Western entities, all the way through to the Japanese and the Manchuria. And they have a very, and understandably so, I'm highly respectful of Chinese views on this, that they were dependent on the West, dependent on the goodwill of Western governments, Western military organizations. It left a very sour taste in their mouths. They do not want to be dependent on anybody. They have great pride as a people. And so being dependent, coming out of the Cultural Revolution and Mao's decades of power, they weren't dependent on the West, but if they wanted technology, they were immediately dependent on the West. And so as they look to grow and expand, their end game, the Chinese, was to have the West dependent on them. And yet, you know, going through in the late 70s and early 80s, as they needed to increase their rate of productivity and value add, they were wholly dependent on the West for technology. So the first pillar is to reduce that dependency. And to do that, they need to grow domestic capacity. They need to build factories. They need to start exporting. They need to move the workforce from agrarian farms, subsistence living, move them into the cities, urban areas where they can be put to work, building products to create, if you will, the factory of the world. And so many of the Chinese policies going back 20 years and more, going back really to the emergence of Deng Xiaoping as the leader succeeding Mao, are really those policies are really designed to cut their dependency as they grow economically, cut the dependency over time on the West for technology.
So just going back to Deng Xiaoping and Mao, when I think of China trying to reduce its dependency overseas, that immediately seems like something that China tried infamously right. under Mao,
right.
Failed
right.
miserably at, and then under Deng opened up, you know, this whole theory of pragmatism opened up right. to the world and you know, skyrocketing growth, private enterprise.
Right.
So, I mean, one strategy, reducing dependency, failed miserably for right. China. They then opened up and expanded to the international market, which worked tremendously right. for them. Right. Why in the world would the state want to go back?
Well, they don't want to go back. They do want to go back to being independent. They don't want to go back to the Mao era of being an island. So, this is really a 40, 50 year game plan for them. How do you go from being this island of poverty to having the rest of the world dependent on China? And so they rolled out these three different strategic pillars. The first was, we need to reduce dependency on the technology. So what Deng did is he imported the technology. He made it easy for Western companies to come in. He made it easy for Chinese businesses to partner with. In fact, he forced partnerships. He forced technology transfers. And the West seemed to be willing to do that. And so we basically want to suck out the technology from the West, you know, impose it in China and these Chinese enterprises, and then we want to cut our dependence. So it's a step one and a step two. The step two is to cut that dependence on the technology to be independent of the West for our technology. That was pillar number one. It was followed seamlessly, really, by pillar number two. which was to dominate domestically. So in order to get the West to invest in China, in order for them to pour money and resources to help build factories, to help teach the Chinese how to make cars, how to make consumer electronics products, how to build locomotives and high-speed rail, we needed those partners to come in, to set up, and to make money doing it. That was the price of admission. The West wanted those benefits. And China, you know, the grand bargain was, okay, you win, we win. But phase two is we will beat you by basically pushing you back out again. We aspire to dominate in China, which is where you're seeing a lot of these initiatives around this program called MIC, Made in China 2025. Which is targeting these select industries. But even beyond those selected 10 broadly defined industries, which continue to get broader, even in industries like consumer products, apparel, sporting goods, and on and on and on, those are not targeted industries, but we're still seeing the Chinese move to dominate vis-a-vis Western firms. And so we're seeing market share increasing from year to year to year in consumer products, in electronics, in luxury goods, and on and on and on, as the Chinese get better and better at manufacturing, at branding, at distribution, at customer service, and so on. And so that's the second pillar, is we got to dominate domestically. Now, the other thing that's part of dominating domestically, and what the Chinese government has been very smart at doing, is in orchestrating mergers within the Chinese system. Enterprise China, it consists of small Chinese companies which have been put together to create these global behemoths. So when you look today at the world's biggest companies, the company, the Global 500 from Forbes, the country with the most big companies is China. And it didn't just happen naturally. It happened because the government orchestrated these mergers. So you had, you know, a $100 billion revenue company and another $100 billion revenue company. The government forced the merger, so now you have a $200 billion revenue company. That was designed for two things. One, to help them dominate domestically by reducing domestic competition. But it was also designed to create national champions with the scale and efficiency such that they could then proceed with pillar three, which is to go out into the rest of the world and to dominate globally. So this is a 30, 40-year game plan that required initially Western companies to pour resources, technology, investment, talent into China, train, upscale Chinese enterprises. Phase two, the enterprises will make it more difficult for Western firms to compete and succeed and stay in China. The Chinese will dominate in China. And phase three is to now take these giant companies and to go out and outcompete the Americans and the Europeans at their own games. Three phases, the three pillars of the Enterprise China strategy.
Okay, so I mean, it certainly seems like this whole three pillar strategy, you know, going back 40, 50 years, is a heck of a thing to try to pull off across generations, across leaders. You know,
absolutely,
takes a tremendous amount of foresight and planning and you know, a regimented structure to stick
right
to that plan.
Right.
So I wanted to finish off today by asking you, what was the most surprising thing that you've learned, the most surprising trend that you observed in researching or writing this book that you really didn't expect?
Yeah, there were several things. One is how smart the Chinese the leadership is. It's easy to underestimate Chinese companies. There are the people running those companies, by and large, are very smart people, very determined people, and not necessarily people who are driven the same way we are by profit. because of the influence of the state, they have, and I'm not saying profit's not relevant, it is relevant, but they have broader ambitions than we would in the West. For us, it's all about, you know, money in the next quarter, the results and so on. And so it makes it difficult for us to think long term. So what impressed me was how smart and disciplined they were. Another thing that impressed me is it's kind of this little, the dirty little secret, if you will, amongst many Western companies, not all, many, is how much money they still make in China. There are many big brand name companies that are basically printing money in China even today. And so from the West, for various public relations reasons, you know, we see these companies, oh, they must be struggling and the Chinese are destroying them. In many cases, that's true. But in many cases, these big brand name companies that we're seeing, you know, dominate Wall Street, they are making out, you know, tons of profits in China. They don't report them. They obfuscate them. They bury them in their financial statements, but nevertheless, they're making lots of money. And so it's not that you competing in China means you're going to lose. It just means that, and this is really the third lesson that we took away from this, is you can compete and win in China, but you can't compete and win using 1980 strategies that you adopted when you went into the country. The country has evolved. It is a very different beast than it was in 1982. And so the way you think about China, how you compete in China and with China has to evolve significantly. And many Western firms are not thinking very smart in smart ways when it comes to evolving and are lacking in the leadership bandwidth to do much about it. So those are the ones that are being caught off guard.
All right. Well, those are all the questions that I have for you today. Thank you so much for joining us on the show, Dr. Morrison.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on the show. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you, everyone, for listening to the Economics Review. And as always, we'll be back soon with the latest.